Time for Sports Lit 101 here on Downtown. Rich Kimble here with Bruce Pratt and Kerry Haskell. And we're happy to welcome back to the show a gentleman who's been with us at least once, more than once.
I think three times.
Yeah, many times before. Miles Schrag joins us to talk about his collaboration with the great Philbert Bailly on Catch Me If You Can. Miles, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you back on with us. Well, let's start from the get-go here. How did you get together with Philbert Bailly?
Well, I came across a man named Ron Davis, who running fans may recognize that name from. He was on the San Jose State national champion cross country team, the first racially integrated cross country NCAA champion in the early 60s. He was at San Jose State as a coach in the late 60s, and then he coached across Africa in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And he coached Philbert, and this is a couple of chapters actually in the book. He coached Philbert to Philbert's silver medal in the steeplechase in the 1980 Olympics. Ron would have been one of the few Americans that were actually at the stadium in Moscow because of the boycott. But Ron had stayed in touch with Philbert. They'd been close all through the years. And so he said this story needs to be written, and he introduced us a couple of years ago. I know we're talking about Philbert here, not Ron, but I do want to say that Ron just passed away earlier this summer, just prior to the book going to the printer, and obviously Philbert being at the Commonwealth Games last month, Ron wasn't able to be there. And so that's sad for all of us because he was a great ambassador for the sport.
One of the things that I find so remarkable about this story, and you tell it so very well, is that we can know as if we're fans of track, we can know about the things that Philbert Bailly accomplished, his world records, his incredible running style. But the story of how he even gets to be a runner, just like your book with Abdi Abdurrahman, is so fascinating. And then what he does after he's no longer running is, again, a fascinating story. Did that draw you as much to it as the running?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I know, Bruce, you and I have talked about this a little bit, and running fans that go back a ways know the incredible impact that Philbert had on the sport with the style, his front-running style. I mean, he revolutionized the sport. That is fascinating, and it's interesting to hear him talk about it, and we obviously address that a lot in the book. But to me, for him to have the dedication that he's had since retirement for his country, his loyalty to his country, his desire to do something meaningful, and his love for his wife and his family, that's all part of it with the school that they created and the foundation they created. That's absolutely a big part of why I was excited to work on it, why I had so much respect for Philbert. And it really is part and parcel with how he approached running tactically, strategically, smart, committed, dedicated, and it leads to a life well lived is the bottom line.
One of the things that I find really fascinating is in his early life, he could just as easily have not even made it to the age of 10. I mean, it wasn't like he grew up in the shadows of Kilimanjaro. His father died very young. He was a cattle merchant today, a cowherd. His mother's 7 months pregnant. She walks all these miles to get to the father, gets there too late, and then comes home and raises this family of boys. And without that incredible lifestyle of working and driving cattle and doing that, I don't know that he would have become the runner that he became, because he didn't have any other way to get around except by foot.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, we're talking about 1950s and 1960s East Africa, Tanganyika, you know, before Tanzania was even had its independence in the early 1960s. This is a very rural landscape that he grew up in. And here again, his devotion to his mother is complete. I mean, he clearly respects her and loves her. She's still alive in the area where he grew up. He didn't want to disappoint her. With his dad having died before Philbert was even born, he had, you know, plenty to do, and he took that seriously. I think it does it does put him on a path to become you know, somebody who does something successful, whether it was running or not, or something else, it could have been a lot of things. And of course he ran in local and regional meets as a teenager, but he was not stellar. He was good. But I think he realized he liked it, and he knew that he was decent at it, and it sort of fell into place when he joined the Army.
We're talking with Miles Schrag on Downtown. The new book is Catch Me If You Can, written with Philbert by E. And one of the things that drew people to Philbert was his unique style. I think you refer to him as being his own rabbit. And Philbert himself says, embracing the role of pace setter would change my life forever. How unique was that at the time?
Well, extremely so. Again, fans of the middle distances going a ways back probably know that, in a sense, that the sport was stagnating a little bit, if you choose to see it that way, in that, 1500 meter runners, mile runners, they'd run the first three quarters of the race in a group, and then it was a sprint to the finish. Philbert, mainly because he was small and didn't want to get trampled, realized that was from the 1972 Olympics and the steeplechase in the 1500. He put himself in a position where he got boxed in, got spiked. He said, I do not want to do that again. So he did it for kind of survival instincts. But what he realized is that he was transforming the way that the sport was run. He pushed people to their limit. He pushed himself to the limit, but he was willing to do that. And that's a hard thing for, I think, most of us who run at a much more leisurely pace. We're not willing to do that. And he was. And what it granted him was the respect of all those guys from the 70s, LaCoury and Walker and Dixon and Coughlin. Those guys revered him because they understood the difficulty in doing what he was doing. And of course, they got better because of it too. Sometimes they beat him, sometimes he held on, but what it meant is that they all had to train at a more aggressive pace and put themselves into oxygen debt in training as well as racing. And then the other part that comes into play during that era is, pacing wasn't really allowed. The understanding was that, if you were at the starting line, you were there to try to win the race. And if you were a pacer that dropped out halfway through, that was unacceptable. Now, of course, that's how it's done. I mean, that's how everybody wants to set records. They get a good pace setter out there, and some of them make an incredibly good living at it. But Philbert, in some ways, and I forget now, I think maybe Rod Dixon had said that to me, that in a way, Philbert was the last legitimate, 1500 and mile record holder, because he did it before pacing became the norm. I mean, that's maybe a little harsh, but I mean, Rod Dixon said that. I believe that's who it was. I want to give him credit for it. He said it out of respect, because he understood the difference in being your own rabbit versus having a rabbit carrying you along.
And what I found fascinating is I always wondered how great a 400 meter runner he might have been had he chosen to do that, because his turnover was just so exceptionally fast. And when I look at these big muscled guys that are running the 4 and the 8 these days, I'm thinking to myself, he would run away from you. And if you had to carry all that muscle down the track, I don't know if that would be the way to go. And I think you hit it on the head. Without the rabbits to push those paces, I mean, here's a guy who broke two of Jim Ryan's records people thought were going to stand for a very long time. And he was, as you pointed out, a little guy. He was an Yvonne Cornwallier in hockey, or Sal Bando in baseball. I mean, he was a little guy. But do you think that the mental discipline he had to develop is what really was the key? I mean, we hear about everybody thinks African runners are born to be better than the rest of everybody else, and they don't give them the credit for how hard they work and for training at altitude and all those things. But do you think it was in his upbringing, it was all the things he had to deal with that gave him that mental toughness to say, I'm just going to go out, catch me?
Yeah, I mean, I think the mental toughness is just off the charts for Philbert. And I completely agree that a lot of East African runners, the assumption is that there's so many great runners there and they don't even have to work hard. And that's ridiculous. I mean, it's just not, it's not a fair way at looking at the talent that's there with people like Philbert. I don't know about a 400. I feel like he almost needed a little bit longer to be able to develop a lead that put his opponents into the discomfort zone that he could, you know, finish them off. So a little bit longer race, like a 1500 or a mile, helped. But yeah, his mental toughness, it shows up. I mean, it even showed up in retirement, or has shown up in retirement, to where he gets things done.
Well, and also, to double the steeplechase in the 1500 is such an odd, I mean, there aren't a lot of steeplechasers who do anything else. And it's a completely different mindset and a very different race and different set of tools. It's not like regular hurdling. I mean, that does speak to some inherent athletic ability that's off the charts.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, he was a pretty decent soccer player, when he was younger, and he played a lot of sports, as, you know, many athletic young people do. But you're right about the steeplechase. And that's, to me, that's one of the most interesting chapters in the book. I mean, he's past his prime at that point. He's dealt with a lot of setbacks, the 1976 boycott of the African nations, to where, you know, people, it's not that people had written him off at that point, but he was past his prime. And people like Cohen, Ovette, and Malinowski, the steeplechaser from Poland, I mean, they'd kind of, you know, gone past him at that point. So he had to make a decision in 79 and 80 when he was training about whether he was going to do the 1500 or the steeplechase. He was planning on doing both, but it was kind of a last minute decision with him and Ron Davis to do the steeplechase. And so this is where the athleticism, I think, comes in. He hated doing the steeplechase. I mean, you talk about an event where you're going to get clobbered, you're going to get spiked, you're going to get beat up. That's it. And so he chose to do a race he had done very few times since the early 70s to compete in 1980. And it paid off. He won Tanzania's first ever Olympic medal, almost got gold. He did get run down there by Malinowski, who was a big guy. What he did there and the how that decision was made and how it came about in those last months before Moscow was interesting to write about and talk with Philbert about. And I hope readers find it interesting to read about.
Along with Philbert's story, it brought back so many memories of some of those great names. You mentioned Emin Coghlan, John Walker, Rod Dixon, Marty Lecoury, Sebastian Coe. It really was a golden age of track.
Steve Fontaine, Byron Dice. I mean, it really was. And the other thing that I was thinking, Miles, that is so good in the book, people don't know that he spent most of his life in the military, that he worked very diligently because he wanted to always have a steady job, and that he fought malaria in a way that was just unbelievable to me. I mean, the people I know that have had malaria talk about years of being knocked down by one bout of it, and he had several bouts with malaria. If track and field were just as popular as it should be in my feeling and your feeling, I think people would revere his name with anybody that's ever been a middle distance and distance shorter distance runner, because yes, he revolutionized it, but man, he did it against a headwind. He was constantly running into a headwind in so many ways.
Yeah. And that's one of the things I love about you, Bruce, is that you're a big track fan. And so I always love talking to you about it. You go back a little farther than I do, but I completely agree with you. And what I find interesting, and we do get into this in the book, I mean, Philbert is a proud man. I think it's accurate to say, and it comes through in the book, that he does feel a little bit overlooked. Now, he has great respect for all those names we just gave. They have respect for him and him for them, as competitors do, as soldiers do, you could say as well. But I do feel like he's been forgotten. I've been amazed, actually, when I was writing it with him and when I've been working on it and promoting it with him, how many people in the United States really don't remember him. Even people that know quite a bit about track and field and middle distance running, the name sort of is lost. And, you know, he's lived his whole life in Tanzania, and so that's a big part of it. He didn't get Olympic gold. He didn't get to compete in the Olympics in his prime, so that's part of it. And yet it doesn't seem fair, because what he did in terms of the style of racing is something that should be revered. And in the book, we talk about Pat Butcher in particular, an author who sort of ridicules Roger Bannister for using pacing in sort of an under the table kind of way, and even, you know, runners who followed Filbert, in the late 70s, 80s, 90s, ever since, have relied on pacers. And he just feels like Filbert Bayi is the name, not Roger Bannister, that we should be looking to as sort of the father of middle distance running.
Well, I sure agree. And I think the other thing is that since he was never a coach or a member of an NCAA team here, that people forget those things. I mean, so many guys who were somehow involved in coaching in the U.S. or work with the U.S. team, you know, being from Tanzania shouldn't mean that you're not as famous on the world stage as an athlete as if you're from Canada or Bosnia-Herzegovina. You know, I mean, it's right. And you know, I was thinking about the similarities with Abdi and the way that he has to come out of war-torn Somalia and reinvent himself. Filbert just comes out of Tanzania and says, I'm a Tanzanian, Tanganyika at the time. This is who I am. My country's gone through some stuff getting united and all, but I'm that's who I am, and that's where I'm from, and that's what I'm going to be from. And I think so many other guys would have been over here looking for a shoe deal later in life and everything else. But for him to dedicate his life to the school that he's established is really, that alone should make him like win a major Nobel Prize or something, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, he did come to the U.S. to get his degree in education at University of Texas, El Paso, but he was hurt at that time. Yeah. Didn't run very long and didn't run very much at all there. I mean, he ran road races and actually was not on the team for most of his career, and he had to pay his own way. Got a little bit of help from the Tanzanian government to help get his degree, but he never had much intention of going anywhere else other than Tanzania. And that's just a noble thing. Obviously, if people want to come to the U.S., I mean, there's opportunity there. You can understand why plenty of athletes have done that. And yet I think it's noble for him to have made the choice that he did. And that's what I find wonderful about talking to him is, yeah, he understands that there are things that he didn't get, like his best shot at an Olympic gold medal. He didn't get rich off of, being at the top of his game. And yet I think he feels good about the decisions that he's made. His family, I mean, I got to go visit him in 2019, and his family were wonderful hosts. And they adore him, and he loves his grandkids. I mean, he's a good man, and I think anybody who's ever met him gets it. And he's intense. I mean, I talked to people like Suleiman Nyambui, training partner for years with him, and he says, like, when you're rooming with him on the road at the meets in Europe in the 70s, or when you're training with him, he is intense. But he's got an infectious laugh, and he's just a wonderful person when he's not locked into that moment of training and racing. And just real quickly about Abdurrahman, who, I worked with him on his book, and I think you make a good point there, Bruce. Both of their stories, I think, are fascinating to me because they overcame the difficulties in their countries and the inherent disadvantages that that runners perhaps in Europe and North America didn't face. Yes, I know we hear about East Africans, they train at altitude and they're physiologically superior, and that's just not really true. It's not an accurate assessment. And of course it's not taking into account the disadvantages they have in terms of coaching and nutrition and the sports science knowledge that back then, especially, the more developed world was really focused on.
Well, Miles, it's a wonderful book. It's one of my favorite books I've ever read on running, and I'm so glad it's part of it. Hope maybe we can find a way to talk to Filbert sometime. I really appreciate you being on with us, and I'm always looking forward to whatever's coming next from Solstice. So thanks so very much for being with us.
We'll keep it coming, and I hope Filbert can get on. We'll do what we can, and thank you both so much for having me.
Thanks, Miles.
Miles Schrag with Filbert Bayi. The book is Catch Me If You Can from Solstice Publishing. Thanks so much to Miles for being with us.